Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 120.
We are exploring the final, breathtaking resolutions of one of the most multi-layered, monumental narratives ever put to paper. We're looking at Chapter 120 of Dream of the Red Chamber.
A truly incredible text.
Yeah, and our goal today is to unpack how this text wraps up its earthly dramas. The crimes, the marriages, the basic human survival of these characters. While simultaneously, pulling back the curtain on its insanely complex supernatural and philosophical framework.
Because we are essentially dealing with three distinct planes of existence converging in this single chapter.
Which is a lot to juggle.
It is. First, you have the gritty, pragmatic reality of a declining aristocratic family desperately trying to stay afloat in a very dangerous political landscape.
Right, the survival aspect.
Exactly. Second, you have the mystical, cosmic realm of predestination, karma, and spiritual debts that absolutely must be paid.
The supernatural layer.
Right. And finally, sitting above all of it, you have a meta-narrative about the very book itself and, well, the nature of storytelling.
Looking over our sources and just the sheer scale of this text, it is staggering. I mean, trying to comprehend the ending of this story is kind of like trying to tie up the plot threads of a 10-season, highly complex prestige TV show.
That's a great way to put it.
Like one with hundreds of characters, dense political intrigue, and brutal family betrayals. But on top of all that worldly drama, you have to factor in immortal beings, reincarnated flowers, and cosmic karmic debt.
What is vital to understand as we dive into the material today is that this isn't just a mechanical wrap-up of plot points.
Right. It's not just checking boxes.
Exactly. The author isn't just telling you what happened to whom. This grand finale is a profound, unifying philosophical statement.
Which we're going to get deep into.
It's an exploration of passion, of familial duty, and ultimately the devastating idea that the reality we cling to every single day might just be an illusion. The source begins not with some dramatic monologue, but with the literal physical collapse.
Mm-hmm.
Another maid, Qwen, runs into the room in a panic to report that Zharin is violently ill.
Right.
So Bochai, his wife, and the rest of the household, I think Gaoji and Pinger are there too, they all rush to her bedside.
And they find a situation that has escalated far past just a mild illness. Zharin is experiencing this unbearable chest pain to the point where she simply faints outright.
Wow.
Yeah, her body is entirely shutting down under the weight of an invisible stressor.
And the response from the other women is, I mean, it's incredibly visceral. They do not just gently pat her forehead with a damp cloth, you know.
No, not at all.
The text notes they pour hot, basically boiling water down her throat to revive her.
Which is intense.
It is sheer panic. They're using a physical shock to counter a massive emotional shock.
Yeah.
But the darkest part of the scene isn't even the boiling water.
Right. It's what comes next.
Exactly. Another character, Kaoji, asks why Zharin is so sick, and Baochai reveals this terrifying timeline. She says Zharin actually cried so hard 3 nights ago that she fainted then too.
That 3-day delay is the critical detail of this entire opening sequence.
Yeah.
It completely sets up the brutal hierarchy of the household.
Okay, wait, I need to pause here because this absolutely blew my mind. Zharin had a complete fainting breakdown 3 days ago. But because the household was, as Baochai puts it, busy with outside affairs, they didn't call a doctor until she collapsed a second time.
Yeah, it's rough.
And the text notes this fascinating little detail about household etiquette. When the doctor arrives in the room, the women all step away to avoid him.
Yeah, that physical separation is standard for the era. High-status women or women in a high-status household wouldn't casually mingle with an outside tradesman or professional like a doctor.
Right, of course.
But narratively, it creates this incredible isolating distance. Zharin is left alone with the clinical gaze of a medical professional who is completely divorced from the personal dynamics of the house.
And his clinical gaze is frustratingly narrow. He comes in, checks her pulse, and gives his official diagnosis. He says her illness is caused by sudden anger or extreme distress.
Which is, yeah.
He writes a prescription and just leaves. It's the 18th century equivalent of a doctor telling you to, like, just take some Advil and try to reduce your stress levels while your house is literally on fire.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Because right after he leaves, the source reveals Sharon's secret terror, the actual thing causing the failing pulse that the doctor completely missed.
Yeah.
She had vaguely heard a rumor that if Baoyu doesn't return, all the women in his room are going to be cast out.
Right. The doctor reads the biological data. He sees an emotional spike in her pulse. But he is entirely blind to the socioeconomic reality causing that spike.
He's missing the context.
Completely. He treats a broken heart, missing that he is actually looking at a woman terrified of losing her home.
Okay, I am actually a bit confused by the mechanics of her financial situation here, though. The text mentions later that the ma'am of the house had been secretly giving Jiren the monthly allowance of an unofficial concubine. That's so she was getting paid well. If she has this elevated allowance, why is she so completely paralyzed by the rumor of being cast out? Like, can't she just save up her elevated pay, pack her bags, and start over somewhere else?
That is a great question, and it gets to the very heart of why this situation is an existential threat and not just, you know, a career setback.
Okay.
In this era, women were essentially property of the patriarchal household. Allowances weren't like modern bank accounts that you could just transfer to a new city.
Oh, I see.
They were internal household funds. More importantly, Shirin has no independent legal identity outside of this estate. If she is cast out, she doesn't go rent an apartment. She is either sold to another family as a servant, married off to whoever the estate chooses, or just left entirely destitute on the street.
Wow.
Yeah, her survival is 100% reliant on her status within these walls.
So when the doctor calls it anger or distress, it is a massive understatement.
Mm-hmm.
She isn't just upset because of a bad breakup. She is staring down the barrel of total societal erasure. Her body is failing because her structural safety net has just evaporated.
The text masterfully intertwines these medical symptoms with socioeconomic terror. The failing heart is the physical manifestation of imminent homelessness.
Imminent homelessness is the perfect way to frame what happens next, actually, because that fear of being erased bleeds directly into her subconscious. The doctor is gone, she's left alone while Quinn is brewing her medicine, and her mind just takes over.
Right.
She slips into this vivid hallucination or a dream state.
When reality refuses to offer any clarity, the subconscious tries to build a narrative out of the trauma.
And the narrative her brain builds is devastating. While the other maid is away getting the medicine, Shirin hallucinates Bao Yu standing right in front of her. But he doesn't look like the aristocratic man she knows.
He looks like a Buddhist monk.
Exactly. And he is holding a register or a book, and he's just flipping through the pages. Then he looks at her and delivers this line, "Don't get the wrong idea. I don't recognize you all anymore."
It's chilling. And the imagery of that book is profound. It isn't just a novel he is reading. In this cultural context, a register implies a settling of accounts, like a cosmic ledger of fates and karmic ties.
If you've ever had someone abruptly end a relationship with you out of nowhere, you might recognize the feeling, but this goes so much deeper. Getting broken up with is one thing, but this dream.
Yeah.
This is like someone looking right through you and saying, "I am literally deleting our entire shared history from my hard drive." It is the ultimate spiritual ghosting.
That's exactly what it is.
Jiren tries to speak to him, to reach him, but she is jolted awake by Kiwin returning with the medicine. She realizes it was just a dream, and she is so disturbed she keeps it a total secret.
It is profound spiritual ghosting because Bao Yu claiming he no longer recognizes them is the ultimate severance of their intimate bond. By holding that cosmic ledger and acting as a monk, he isn't just saying, "I don't love you anymore." He is saying the karmic ties that bound us in the human realm have been officially severed. He has exited the emotional contract they shared and stepped entirely out of the human social fabric.
He has opted out of the human experience, period. And this deeply disturbing dream forces Yurin to wake up and basically play detective with her own life.
She has to.
She needs to rationally analyze Bao Yu's recent real-world behavior to see if this spiritual ghosting she dreamed about is actually mirroring reality.
She's sifting through her recent memories to verify if the signs of his detachment were there all along, just hiding in plain sight.
So after forcing down her medicine, she starts putting the pieces together. She deduces that Bao Yu must have followed a monk away from the estate. And she recalls this one specific telling incident.
The jade amulet.
Yes. The last time he tried to take his jade amulet out, which is a huge symbol of his identity, it looked like he was trying to escape. When Yurin grabbed him to physically stop him, he shoved her away.
And the physical mechanics of that shove are deeply important. The text notes he did it with a mixed pushing and rubbing, completely devoid of any of his usual affection or grace.
It wasn't a passionate fight.
Yeah.
It was clumsy and numb. He just pushed her aside like an object blocking a doorway.
Right.
Furthermore, she remembers he had been acting increasingly annoyed with Bao Chai, his wife, and showed zero affection to any of his other sisters. Jiren has this horrific epiphany. This coldness wasn't a passing mood swing, she realizes. This absolute detachment is exactly what achieving enlightenment looks like.
And this is where the text executes a truly revolutionary pivot in its philosophy.
It completely flips the script on what a spiritual journey means. Because Yurin literally asks herself, you achieved enlightenment, but what about abandoning Vajrayana?
She challenges it directly.
She really does. Is the author actually suggesting that spiritual salvation is inherently selfish because it requires you to break the human arts around you?
The text is absolutely making that subversion. In traditional Buddhist narratives, achieving enlightenment, escaping the cycle of samsara, the suffering of the physical world is the ultimate glorious achievement.
Right, it's at the goal.
It is a holy triumph. But the author filters this triumph strictly through the perspective of the people left behind in the dirt. From the vantage point of Jiren and Baochai, enlightenment is a deeply cruel, selfish abandonment of worldly responsibilities.
It's like, congratulations on finding your inner peace and achieving cosmic nirvana, but your wife is crying in the next room and I'm about to get evicted.
Exactly.
It completely strips the romance away from the lone seeker on a mountain trope.
It highlights the friction between the two dominant philosophies of the time. The Buddhist desire to detach from the world and the Confucian obligation to maintain the social and familial order.
Oh, that makes sense.
By achieving Buddhist detachment, Bao Yu commits the ultimate Confucian sin. He abandons his duty to his family. He leaves them to clean up the wreckage of his spiritual awakening.
Cleaning up the wreckage brings us perfectly back to Zirin's immediate nightmare. Accepting that Baiyu is truly gone and that his holy enlightenment is really just a fancy word for abandoning them, she is forced to look at her own practical reality.
Which is bleak.
Very. If you've ever been caught in a corporate restructuring without a clear job title, you're going to feel this administrative trap in your bones.
She is trapped in the ultimate precarious position, holding all of the vulnerability and none of the institutional protection.
Right. Let's look at Shirin's status. As we discussed earlier, the madam of the house had assigned her to serve Baiyu and gave her the monthly allowance, fitting an unofficial concubine, or like a highly elevated roommate.
Yes.
But here is the fatal flaw. This arrangement was never officially declared to the master and madam in a formal public way. It was an off-the-books promotion.
And in a society that relies entirely on rigid, formal titles to dictate a person's worth and legal standing, an off-the-books arrangement is practically worthless when the patron disappears.
So now she is caught in an impossible catch-22. If the household management decides to kick her out because Baiyu is gone, she is trapped. She can't fight to stay, because without that official title, the madam can just deny the arrangement to save face.
Right, they'd just pretend it never happened.
Exactly. Shirin would become a laughingstock with no ground to stand on. But if she leaves quietly, her emotional memory of Baiyu's past affection makes the departure absolutely unbearable. The paradox is so crushing that she actually thinks to herself, might as well die and be done with it.
The administrative limbo is literally pushing her towards suicidal ideation.
It is like doing the job of a vice president, getting the paycheck of a VP, but your official HR title is still intern.
Yeah, that's rough.
When the company downsizes and your boss leaves, you have zero legal protection. HR looks at the paperwork, sees intern, and cuts you loose. She is trapped in a fatal administrative loophole.
The VP and intern analogy captures the bureaucratic terror perfectly, but there is an added layer of intimacy here that makes it so much worse.
You don't usually live with your VP and build your entire romantic and emotional life around them?
What we are seeing is a brilliant portrayal of the extreme vulnerability of women in this hierarchy.
Absolutely.
Her entire existence, her financial security, her social standing, her romantic life, it all depends entirely on a verbal agreement from management and the continued presence of a man who just checked out of society to become a monk. The moment he removes himself, her entire foundation turns to dust.
She is an unofficial entity in a system that only protects official titles. It is devastating. But despite wanting to just die and escape the trap, the medicine she forced down earlier actually kicks in.
Yeah, the body takes over.
Her body betrays her desire to give up. The medicine physically lessens her chest pain, and she realizes she can't just lie in bed forever waiting for the end.
The physical body demands to keep living, forcing her to participate in the reality she wants to escape.
She forces herself out of bed. And a few days later, she resumes her duties serving Baochai. And right here, the source does this incredible cinematic pan. It shifts the narrative focus from Jiren, the servant, to the other major victim of Baiyu's enlightenment, his official wife, Baochai.
We move from the unofficial casualty to the official casualty, the intern to the CEO, essentially.
And Baochai's internal state is just as wrecked. She is secretly weeping, mourning her missing husband, and the bitter fate of being essentially widowed without a body to bury.
It's a different kind of grief.
But on top of this profound emotional wreckage, she is dealing with literal, legal, and financial ruin. The text notes that her mother is frantically trying to redeem her brother from a crime, and Baochai, with a broken heart and a missing husband, has to help plan the legal strategy and figure out the bailout.
She doesn't even have the luxury of purely grieving. She has to manage a criminal crisis while her world falls apart.
The stark contrast the text presents here is brilliant. Notice how effortlessly the narrative pans from the servant's crisis to the master's crisis. It makes this profound statement. It doesn't matter your class. It doesn't matter if you are the unofficial concubine or the legally recognized wife.
Right.
When the center of your universe vanishes, you still have to wake up, get out of bed, swallow your bitter medicine, and deal with the paperwork.
Yeah.
You still have to manage the fallout.
That shared burden really highlights the ultimate irony. To ground this, I feel like we really need to start with the most striking visual and emotional climax of the entire source text.
The riverbank scene.
Yes, we are talking about the final physical encounter between father and son, Jia Xing and Bao Yu. But to even understand the weight of this encounter, we have to look at the sheer amount of trauma Jia Xing is carrying in this moment.
Because Jia Xing is a man who really represents the Orthodox Confucian patriarchal order.
He's the rule follower.
Throughout the narrative, he is the enforcer of rules, the pillar of the establishment. And by the time we reach this scene, he is completely exhausted.
I mean, physically and emotionally.
Right. He is on a boat returning from Jianling, where he has just been tasked with burying several key members of his family.
The text lists them out, and it's just an agonizing toll. He's buried the family matriarch, Jia Mu.
Right.
He's buried Qin Shi, the really capable manager, Wing Shifeng, the fiercely loyal maid, Yuan Yang, and the deeply tragic Lin Dayu.
It's devastating.
And we aren't just talking about a modern funeral. We are talking about a literal geographical journey of death. Moving coffins across the country in Imperial China is a massive, physically and emotionally draining undertaking.
Absolutely. He is steeped in mourning. He is carrying the physical and emotional weight of a collapsing dynasty on his shoulders.
Because the family is in ruins at this point.
Exactly. The Jia family estate has been raided, properties confiscated, and their social standing completely decimated.
But then, and this is where the whiplash comes in, as he travels on this grim journey, he experiences this wild, disorienting roller coaster of news.
The messengers arrive.
Right. Messengers arrive with letters stating that his son, Bao Yu, and his grandson, Jialan, have both passed the grueling imperial exams.
And we really should pause on the imperial exams for a second because we need to understand the magnitude of this.
Yeah. Passing these exams isn't like getting a good SAT score.
Not at all. The imperial examination system was the sole pathway to bureaucratic power and social survival in imperial China.
It was literally make or break.
It was notoriously brutal. Candidates were locked in tiny cells for days, writing rigid, highly formalized essays.
Just grueling.
The pass rate was minuscule. Earning the title of Jurin, which Bao Yu and Jialan achieve, elevates you to the elite scholar gentry class.
It changes everything.
It means you are eligible for government office. It means social prestige, legal privileges, and immense wealth.
It is the ultimate ticket back to power and safety for a disgraced family.
Furthermore, Jia Xing learns that the emperor has granted a pardon.
Oh, right, the pardon.
This pardon returns his confiscated properties.
The family has been granted an imperial amnesty. Jia Shi and Jia Zhen.
They are pardoned.
So in the span of a few days, this guy goes from burying the remnants of his family in total disgrace to having his wealth, his status, and his lineage entirely secured.
It's an unbelievable reversal of fortune.
But there's a massive catch in the letters. They also state that right after taking the exams, Bao Yu went missing.
Just vanished.
So Jia Xing is rushing home, oscillating between the highest possible worldly triumph and the terrifying panic of a missing heir.
Which brings us to the encounter at the piling station.
Right. It is a freezing, snowy day. The boat is moored. Jia Xing is sitting alone in the cabin, writing a letter home. And then he looks up.
And here's where the imagery gets incredibly jarring.
Because Jia Xing is obviously expecting to see a victorious scholar, right? But what he actually sees is closer to an apparition.
Through the faint, swirling snow, he sees a figure on the bow of the boat. He is Bao Yu.
But he doesn't look like a scholar.
No, you're right. He isn't dressed in the triumphant official robes of a Jurin. He is completely bareheaded and barefoot in the freezing snow.
Which is just a wild image.
And draped over his shoulders is a massive, bright red cape made of felt.
Jia Xing rushes out to meet him, but Bai Yu doesn't say a single word.
Total silence.
He just silently drops to the ground and bows four times to his father. And before Jia Xing can ask a question or grab hold of him, a monk and a Taoist suddenly appear on the boat.
They flank Bai Yu, declare worldly ties are finished, and they whisk him away.
Just like that. And as they vanish, they sing a cryptic song about Injing Peak and returning to the Great Wasteland.
Jia Xing tries to chase them. He runs slipping and sliding across the icy ground, but they disappear.
He's just left staring at a completely blank, white, snowy wilderness.
It's such a powerful scene.
But it creates a massive sense of whiplash because, strictly from a human worldly perspective, this makes zero sense.
Not at all.
His son just conquered the hardest intellectual gauntlet in the empire. It's like winning a massive multi-million dollar lottery, taking the ticket all the way to the payout counter, and instead of cashing it in, you silently drop it into a roaring fire and walk out into the woods.
That's a perfect analogy.
Why does Bai Yu do this? And the silence, like, why not just say, hey, Dad, I'm actually a magical entity. My work here is done. Goodbye.
Well, the silence and the specific visual imagery are the keys to unlocking the philosophical framework of the story.
Let's break that down.
Let's look at the colors first. You have this incredibly stark contrast, the pure blank white snow.
Which represents what, exactly?
In Buddhist and Taoist symbolism, this represents the void, emptiness, the cleansing of all attachments, and ultimate spiritual enlightenment.
Okay, so the snow is enlightenment.
Right. And against that immense white background, you have this singular blazing streak of red.
The red cape. Which, you know, feels so incredibly out of place on a freezing, barefoot ascetic.
Exactly. In this literary tradition, red dust is a well-known metaphor for the mortal world.
Ah, red dust.
It represents human passion, emotional entanglements, desires, and the inevitable suffering that comes with them.
So the cape is the mortal world.
Yes. Bai Yu, wearing this heavy red cape, standing barefoot in the purifying snow, is the ultimate visual representation of a spiritual being who has endured the heavy friction of the mortal world, is wearing the accumulation of those passions, but is now finally shedding them.
Wow. That makes the visual so much more profound. He is quite literally wearing the mortal world.
Precisely.
But what about the silence? Why doesn't he speak?
The silence is crucial because human language itself is a construct of the red dust.
How so?
Language is built entirely on worldly distinctions. Good and bad, father and son, love and hate, high status and low status.
Right, labels.
Exactly. Bai Yu has transcended these distinctions. He has returned to his original state of enlightenment. Human language is simply no longer necessary.
It's beneath him now, in a way.
Or just not applicable to his new state of being. Any words he could possibly speak to Jia Xing would just create more worldly entanglement, more karma.
So he just bows instead.
The four bows are his final acknowledgement of his earthly debt to his parents. Once that is paid, there is nothing left to say.
And the text notes that in this silent, devastating moment, Jia Xing finally gets it. He stops seeing a rebellious teenager and starts seeing the metaphysical truth.
The text explicitly states that Jia Xing suddenly realizes his son was a borrowed womb.
Borrowed womb, that's a striking phrase.
It is a fascinating concept in Eastern metaphysics.
Mm.
It implies that Bai Yu was never truly his son in a spiritual sense.
He was just passing through.
Right. He was an immortal entity who merely borrowed the physical vessel of Wang Furen's womb to undergo a 19-year earthly tribulation.
So everything he did.
All of Bai Yu's eccentricity, his refusal to conform to Confucian norms, his intense obsession with the girls in the garden, it wasn't just teenage rebellion or a personality defect.
Right.
It was the specific nature of a cosmic entity experiencing human passion to its absolute limit before discarding it.
Okay, so Bai Yu gets his beautiful, clean exit into the snow. He achieves enlightenment, but spiritual ascension creates a physical vacuum, you know?
Absolutely.
The people he leaves behind don't get to step into a snowy void. They are stuck in the messy, terrifying reality of a disgraced estate that still needs to function.
Which brings us to how these surviving characters navigate the fallout.
Exactly. This is where the text showcases its incredible psychological realism, I think.
Because spiritual ascension is poetically beautiful, but the people left behind still have to eat, survive, and maintain their social standing in a very dangerous empire.
We see this immediately in how the Jia and Shu families process the supernatural event.
Right.
The reactions of the women in his life are fascinating. We look at Wang Furen, Bao Yu's mother, and Bao Chai, his very young wife.
They receive Jia Zhang's letter detailing this vanishing act.
And Bao Chai, who has essentially just been abandoned to be a lifelong widow, she weeps, yes, but she maintains complete unwavering composure.
Complete composure. While Wang Furen initially feels completely abandoned, bitter, and heartbroken.
But then Wang Furen makes this incredible pivot. She is comforted by one specific biological fact. Bao Chai is pregnant.
That pregnancy changes the entire calculus of the tragedy for these families.
It really does. The family actually sits around and rationalizes Bao Yu's exit.
They decide collectively that it's actually better to have birthed a Buddha, an enlightened being who brings cosmic merit to the family by ascending, than to have a son who stays in the mortal world, becomes a flawed government official, makes a political mistake, and gets the whole family executed or ruined later on.
It's a stunning piece of rationalization.
It really is.
As a modern reader, it's almost shocking how quickly they pivot from devastating, life-altering grief to cold, hard pragmatism.
They could definitely read that way.
I mean, wait, Wang Furen is basically saying, well, my son completely abandoned us, but at least we have a pregnant daughter-in-law and a grandson who already passed his exams and can get a high-paying government job.
Right.
Isn't that incredibly cold? It feels like watching a corporate board of directors restructure the company after the CEO unexpectedly quits.
That analogy actually works perfectly for this era.
Really?
Yes. It feels cold to our modern sensibilities because we are deeply conditioned to prioritize individual fulfillment, romantic happiness, and personal closure.
Right, the whole follow your heart mentality.
Exactly. But to understand their reaction, we must understand the traditional machinery of the feudal aristocratic family unit.
So the family isn't a support group for individuals, it's the actual enterprise.
Precisely. In Qing Dynasty aristocratic society, the family is a single continuous organism. The individual is just a temporary cell within that organism.
Ah.
The ultimate goal, above all personal happiness, is the unbroken chain of the lineage. Wang Furen isn't being sociopathic. She is performing her strict duty as a matriarch. The survival of the family is paramount.
Which means Bao Yu's individual disappearance is a personal tragedy, but the lineage surviving via the pregnancy and the exam results is the actual structural victory.
This completely recontextualizes Bao Kai's reaction as well.
How so?
Throughout the entire narrative, Bao Kai is constantly praised for her cool and bland nature. She is the foil to the highly emotional, passionate Lin Daiyu.
Right, she's the grounded one.
Bao Chai doesn't let her passions rule her. And here in the finale, we see exactly why that trait was so highly valued by the society. It was her destiny.
Wow.
Her stoicism allows her to bear this immense tragedy gracefully. She doesn't collapse. She ensures the stability of the household and the protection of the unborn heir. She absorbs the blows so the corporate entity of the family can survive.
And survive they do. The text shows a rapid, pragmatic revival of these families. Jialan, the grandson, is a successful jurin now, which ensures future political protection and prosperity.
Right.
Even Kyoji, who was nearly sold off into human trafficking during the chaos of the family's fall, has her fate settled. With the help of the peasant woman Lu Laolao, she is married into the rural Zhu family.
Now, on paper, marrying into the Zhu family is a massive downgrade in social status.
Because they're rural.
Yes. She is moving from a duke's mansion in the capital to a rural farming family in the provinces. But the text frames it as a profound victory.
Because it's an escape.
Yes, exactly. The Zhu family is respectable. They are a studying family. But most importantly, they are completely safe from the volatile, deadly political purges of the capital.
So it's safety over status?
The high aristocracy is shown to be a precarious cliff where one wrong move gets your entire estate confiscated. The rural farming life represents a return to solid ground, to natural rhythms, and to safety.
That makes total sense. Even the chaotic Su family gets a resolution.
Right, Su Pan.
Su Pan, who has spent the entire novel as the definition of a wealthy, violent, problem child literally getting away with murder because of his family's connections, is pardoned.
An incredible turn of events for him.
And he doesn't just get off the hook. In a surprising moment of maturity, he swears a dramatic, blood-curdling oath never to cause trouble again. He then officially elevates Xi Yingling, his long-suffering concubine, to be his official first wife.
We see the mechanics of imperial amnesties at play here. When a new emperor ascends, or during major state celebrations, broad pardons were often issued to clear out the prisons and start fresh. Japan benefits from this systemic pragmatism.
What's fascinating to me is how the broader society, and even the emperor himself, absorbs the purely mystical event of Bayou vanishing.
That's a great detail.
When the emperor hears about Bayou literally disappearing into the snow with magical beings, he doesn't launch an inquisition. He doesn't panic about witchcraft.
No, he doesn't.
He just declares that Bayou must have been a profoundly unique individual, and he awards Bayou the official title of Wenmiao Zenren, which translates roughly to profoundly wondrous true man.
It is a brilliantly subtle critique of the state.
Oh, how so?
The state apparatus encounters the ineffable, the genuinely supernatural, and its only response is to bureaucratize it.
That's hilarious.
They give the divine a government title and file it away. The earthly world takes the spiritual, categorizes it, and simply moves on with the business of living. The families stabilize, the lineage continues, and the practical world reasserts its dominance over the mystical.
But that earthly pragmatism, you know, that ability to just move on and restructure, only works for the people at the top of the hierarchy.
Yes, absolutely.
It works for the matriarchs and the emperors who had the luxury of agency. But what happens to the people at the bottom, the people who are caught in the gears of this family machine?
There's the dark side of this survival.
Which brings us to perhaps the most heartbreaking storyline in the entire text. The tragic bind of the maid, Shurin.
Shurin's resolution is one of the most psychologically complex moments in the novel.
Let's give some context on her. Because Shurin never had an official status as Baoyu's concubine-like, there was no formal ceremony, she wasn't legally recognized, they decide it would be completely inappropriate for her to stay in the household and act like a grieving widow.
In the rigid social structure of the Qing dynasty, allowing a young, attractive maid to play the role of a lifelong chaste widow for a man she wasn't formally married to would invite intense scandal, gossip, and mockery. It would look improper.
Right. So what would they do? They decide they have to marry her off and get her out of the house.
But they do try to do right by her, in their own way.
True, because they genuinely appreciate her years of loyal service to Baoyu. They arrange a marriage for her and provide a massive, very generous dowry. In their minds, they are doing a profoundly good deed. They are setting up a servant for a very comfortable, respectable life.
But for Shurin, this good deed is an absolute nightmare. It weaponizes kindness against her, placing her in an impossible, suffocating moral dilemma.
Let's lay out the exact mechanics of this catch-22, because it is brilliant and devastating.
Yeah.
Shurin's personal moral code, shaped by the culture she lives in, she wants to commit suicide to prove her absolute loyalty and chastity to Baoyu. She wants to be the ultimate, tragic, loyal servant.
That is the narrative she wants for herself.
Mm.
But she is boxed in by the social web she exists in.
Exactly.
If she commits suicide while still living in the Jia household, it will look like the family forced her into it. It will ruin Wang Furin's reputation for benevolence and completely invalidate the matriarch's good intentions in giving her that generous dowry.
It's the ultimate guilt trip. Okay, so she thinks, I'll accept the marriage, leave the house, go back to my brother's house, and die there before the wedding.
But there's a problem with that, too.
Right. If she goes home and commits suicide, she ruins her brother. Her brother is the one who officially arranged this new match with the groom. If the bride kills herself on his watch, the brother faces the wrath of the groom's family, severe social fallout, and potential financial ruin.
She is literally trapped by politeness.
Trapped by politeness.
She is trapped by the obligations of a patriarchal society, where her life is tied to the honor of the people above her. She is crushed by their kindness.
So reluctantly, having no other option that doesn't destroy someone else, she gets in the wedding palanquin. She marries a man named Jiang Yuhan.
And then on their wedding night, we get this breathtaking cinematic reveal.
I love this scene so much. As they are unpacking her trunks in the bridal chamber, the new husband, Jiang Yuhan, sees a bright red sweatband among her things.
Really?
And Jianan looks over and sees that he possesses a specific green sweatband.
And the realization hits them both like a ton of bricks.
Because of what happened years ago?
Yes. Years ago, in a seemingly minor scene, Baoyu had swapped these exact sashes between the two of them.
Wow.
Without Jiren and Jiang Yuhan ever meeting, Baoyu had unknowingly acted as the karmic matchmaker for their union. They realized their marriage wasn't just a random pragmatic arrangement by the matriarchs. It was predestined.
And this leads to the final agonizing twist for Shurin.
It does.
Jiang Yuhan realizes who she is. He was a friend of Baoyu's. and he treats her with overwhelming tenderness, respect, and deep affection.
Which completely ruins everything for her.
Exactly. The text literally says his tenderness leaves her no place to die.
She's completely trapped.
She can't kill herself to escape a monster because he is incredibly kind. She can't be the tragic martyr. So I have to ask, does the text judge her for not dying? Because in traditional stories of this era, the loyal woman always finds a way to die for her honor, no matter the cost.
This is where the source text elevates itself far above standard morality tales.
Okay.
The text introduces the philosophical concept of budi. This translates roughly to unavoidable or having absolutely no other choice.
So the author is giving her grace. He's saying, we understand why you couldn't be the perfect martyr.
Exactly. The text explicitly states, since antiquity, the hardest thing is simply to die. It acknowledges the immense, almost impossible psychological weight of choosing death when life, even an undesired life, is actively pulling you forward with kindness and obligation.
And it notes that she is placed in the supplementary register of the fates rather than the main one.
Yes. The author is making a profound sociological commentary here.
Yeah.
He is showing how systemic constraints, societal expectations, the mechanics of family honor, and even human kindness can completely override an individual's rigid moral desires. Sharon desperately wanted to be a tragic hero, but the world forced her to just be a survivor. It is a uniquely empathetic, nuanced view of compromised virtue.
It's so tragic, but also so deeply human. So we have Baoyu ascending into the void, the family surviving through pragmatic restructuring, and Yiren trapped by the unavoidable weight of fate. We've seen what happens.
Right.
Jiazeng reunites with the male relatives, Jiaxi and Jiazhen. And when the female family members come out to greet him, naturally they start crying over the missing Baoyu.
It's a highly emotional reunion after immense suffering.
But Jiazeng shuts it down instantly. He barks at them to stop the tears.
Cold.
Extremely cold. He lays down an absolute principle. From now on, the men manage the outside, the women manage the inside, and there will absolutely not be the kind of laxity and looseness that define their past.
He mandates a strict division of labor. He decrees that each branch of the family must now manage its own affairs.
They're dismantling the whole system.
Exactly. That centralized, bloated system where everyone just dipped into a massive communal pot without any accountability that's over.
But to explain why all these specific tragedies, resolutions, and exact karmic pairings had to happen, the narrative zooms entirely out. It leaves the messy domestic drama behind and brings us to a philosophical summit.
We move away from the mansions of the capital and arrive at a highly symbolic location, a chance meeting between two men at a river crossing.
The text is incredibly specific about the location. It's called the Rapid Current Ford, Awakening from Illusion Ferry.
Yeah, it's not exactly subtle, is it?
No. The author is planting a massive neon sign here, telling the reader to pay attention to the metaphysics.
Very much so.
Here, we find a character named Jia Yukin. We've known him since chapter one. He was once a powerful, deeply corrupt official, but he has finally been stripped of his title, banished, and reduced to a commoner, and he runs into a Taoist named Zhen Xian.
Zhen Xian is another character who appeared at the very beginning of the novel.
Full circle.
He is a wealthy man who lost his daughter to kidnappers, lost his home to a fire, and eventually achieved enlightenment and wandered off.
Mm-hmm.
Now he acts as the cosmic explainer, tying the entire metaphysical framework together.
So Yukin asks him what the deal is with Baoyu and everything that happened to the Jia family. And Xian reveals the grand metaphysical truth. He explains that Baoyu's jade, the magical stone he was born with, wasn't just a shiny rock. It was an artifact sent to the mortal realm specifically to avoid a cosmic disaster and to complete a predestined match.
And now that the karmic debt is paid, it has returned to its origin.
But Xian goes much further. He explains the tragic fates of all the brilliant, beautiful women we've followed in the story. Lin Dayu, Bao Chai, Shifeng. He says they all originated from the heaven of passion and the sea of sin.
And he makes a crucial, incredibly important distinction here.
What's that?
He says it's not just base lust, which the text calls yin, that ruins people. He argues that romantic passion king is equally entangling and karmically dangerous.
This is perhaps the most vital philosophical pillar of the entire text.
Absolutely.
Wait, I need to stop you there, because this fundamentally challenges how we are conditioned to read literature.
It really does.
As modern readers, you know, raised on Western rom-coms, Shakespeare, and Victorian novels, we are entirely conditioned to view romantic passion as the ultimate human ideal.
Yes, it's the pinnacle for us.
True love, deep emotional connection, sacrificing everything for your soulmate. These are the things we are taught make life worth living. They are the highest good. To hear that King's soulful, poetic romance is actually a heavier karmic trap than base lust, that completely upends everything.
It does. And to understand this, we have to immerse ourselves in the Eastern philosophical worldview, specifically a complex blend of Buddhist and Taoist thought that underpins the novel.
How does this framework view love as a trap?
In this framework, the ultimate goal of existence is tranquility, balance, and eventual enlightenment, a return to the pure void, the white snow we saw earlier.
Right.
Anything that tethers you to the mortal world, the red dust, is a hindrance. It creates friction.
So baselustian is obviously bad because it's purely selfish, fleeting, and usually destructive to society.
Right. Lust is a simple crime with a simple punishment. But what Sheehan is explaining to you, Ken, is that elevated, poetic, soulful romance king is almost more dangerous because it is so incredibly beautiful. It is insidious.
Let me try an analogy here.
Go for it.
Base lust is like stealing a candy bar. It's a clear, selfish sin. You get caught, you pay the fine, it's over.
Mm-hmm.
But deep, poetic passion is like co-signing a 30-year mortgage with someone's soul. It's beautiful. You are building a home together, but you are now inextricably legally bound to their suffering, their debts, and their fate. You've tied a massive knot in the universe.
That is a phenomenal way to look at it. When you love someone deeply, you mourn them when they are gone. You worry about them constantly. You create profound attachments, debts of gratitude, and resentments when they fail you. You bind your soul to theirs.
You generate karma.
You generate a mountain of karma. Every tear Linda Yu sheds for Baoyu is a karmic weight holding her to the earth.
Wow.
The text asserts a universal law of blessing the good and punishing the wicked or lustful. But it also suggests that even the most beautiful, noble earthly attachments are spiritual burdens. They're illusions that keep you trapped in the endless cycle of reincarnation and suffering.
Which perfectly explains Sheehan's final revelation in this scene. He tells Yukun they have to wrap up this conversation because he has one last job to do. He has to go guide the spirit of a Shangling.
Yes, the long-suffering concubine we mentioned earlier who was just elevated to first wife by Su Pan after his pardon.
Right. Sheehan reveals she's destined to die in childbirth very soon. But he frames it not as a terrible tragedy, but as the successful completion of her karmic duty.
Exactly.
She leaves an heir for the Shu family, her mortal debt is paid in full, and now her spirit can finally be released from the mortal realm.
There's an immense, almost painful tension here for the reader.
Because we care about these characters.
Exactly. The author just spent 120 chapters writing some of the most beautiful, nuanced, and poetically devastating romantic encounters in human literature. He clearly loves these characters and understands the depth of their passion.
Right.
Yet, philosophically, he is forcing us to accept this harsh judgment that all of it, no matter how beautiful, is a spiritual burden that must eventually be discarded to achieve true peace.
It's a bitter pill to swallow. It makes you question everything you just read. But the author isn't done playing with our minds, because once we've resolved the characters' earthly lives and we've had this grand metaphysical explanation of their spiritual meanings, the text does something incredibly modern.
It really does.
It breaks the fourth wall entirely.
This is where we look at the meta-ending. The text pulls back one final layer and tells us exactly how the book itself, the physical object you are holding, came to be in our hands.
It traces the literal journey of the manuscript. It starts with the monk and the Taoist returning the magical stone to its original resting place at Qingjing Peak.
And remember, this stone was the entity that took on the borrowed womb and lived as Baoyu.
Right. So the stone is back on the mountain, sitting in the wasteland. And then a character named Kongkong Darin, which translates to something like Vanitas or Taoist of emptiness, is just walking by. He sees the stone and he notices that the text carved onto the stone has been updated.
It now includes the end of the story we just read.
So he meticulously copies it down. He becomes the first transcriber of the myth.
But he needs to publish it. He wants to share it with the world.
Naturally.
So he goes looking for someone to help him. He eventually wanders to that same fairy hut we just talked about, the Awakening from Illusion Fairy, and he finds Jia Yukun fast asleep.
The disgraced official who just learned the secrets of the universe from Sheehan.
Yes. Vanitas tries to wake him up to show him the manuscript, but Yukon, still half asleep, essentially brushes him off. But he directs Vanitas to go find a specific man in the capital.
Who is it?
He says, go find a man named Cal Shuiken, who lives in the Nostalgia Studio, or the Studio of Mourning the Red.
And Cal Shuiken is, of course, the actual historical author of the novel.
Which is incredibly trippy.
So Vanitas takes this manuscript to Cal Shuiken, and when presented with this grand, cosmic, tragic manuscript detailing the fall of empires and the karmic debts of immortals, Cal Shuiken just laughs. He accepts the manuscript, but he categorizes it as words of Jia Yukon. And there is a brilliant linguistic pun in Chinese here, right?
Yes. Jia Yukun Yan sounds exactly like the phrase for fiction or false words.
So the author is deliberately downplaying its importance.
He explicitly declares that this manuscript is not meant for important government officials to analyze. It's not a historical record. He says it's just a silly story, something to be shared with a few friends over wine on a rainy night to cure loneliness.
I just love how wildly meta this is. It is exactly like the director of a movie walking onto the set during the final scene, being handed a DVD of the very movie he is currently directing by a fictional character from the movie, and looking at it and saying, ah, nice script, we should watch this later.
That is exactly what it's like.
Why go through all these elaborate layers of fake authorship?
There are two main reasons, and they work in tandem. First, there is the incredibly practical aspect of plausible deniability.
Protection from the state.
Exactly. This novel contains incredibly sharp critiques of the feudal system, the deep corruption of government officials, and the profound hypocrisy of the aristocracy.
Dangerous stuff to write about.
Very dangerous. In the literary inquisitions of the Qing dynasty, writing such things could get your entire family executed.
Yikes.
By creating this massive chain of transmission, a magical stone, a wandering monk, a sleeping, disgraced official, and finally claiming the whole thing is just a pun on false words or absurdity, the author protects himself from political censorship or persecution. He can always hold up his hands and say, don't look at me, it's just a crazy story I found copied from a rock.
But it's not just a political shield, is it? It serves a narrative purpose, too.
The second reason is much deeper philosophically. These layers of distancing simultaneously elevate the text to the status of a cosmic myth. By having the author literally write himself into the end of the story, accepting it from a metaphysical being, he blurs the line between reality and fiction entirely.
It makes you question what is real and what is the dream.
Which is perfectly encapsulated in the final poem of the novel. The author writes, when it gets to the bitter and sad parts, the absurdity is even more tragic. It's all the same dream, don't laugh at the foolishness of the world.